name is Nathan O'Neill. I am a CPE student here. I do have an interest in becoming a pen test engineer. That is my primary goal. But one of the things related to that that's of most interest to me, that's really, I guess you could call my passion, is social engineering. So tonight, I'm going to give a little presentation on it, kind of give you an idea of what it is, maybe see some of the importance of it, and some of the things that we need to do to address some aspects of social engineering that we're not doing in today's world. I'm going to start off with a few facts. I mean, how many of you really think social engineering is all that important? Well, there was some research done that says, and they came back saying that more than 2.8 million emails are sent every second. And of those 2.8 million, 90% of them are spam, viruses, and phishing emails. Attorney group Falling Hope stated that 60% of employees have admitted to stealing data when they leave a company. It's a fairly staggering number. Research done by Microsoft himself said that about 1 out of every 14 programs downloaded is malicious. Something to think about. And social engineering played a role in nearly every attack in 2011 that has been labeled as the year of the hack. Companies like H.B. Gary, Sony, Lockheed Martin, Citibank, even PBS was hacked, and all involved some form of social engineering. So you can see that this is something that needs to be more clearly addressed. Little disclaimer here. Felt like I threw this, throw this in here, just make sure that nobody come back to me or, you know, get in trouble for nothing. So. Overview of the presentation, I'm going to cover what is social engineering, some of the types of social engineering attacks, so the social engineering framework, some of the tools of the trade, and prevention and mitigation. So what is social engineering? Some audience participation here. What do you think social engineering is?
Having to deal with people.
One aspect of it, yeah. Well, the social engineering in itself is nothing new. It's been around ever since someone first wanted something from somebody else. Growing up, I would always go to my mom, I'd ask a question. Say, what is this? What does this mean? She'd always turn around and tell me, go look it up. So that's what I'm going to start out here doing. We'll start out with some definitions. The definition defines social as relating to the interaction or welfare of individuals in the community. Okay, so we got that down. Engineering, the art of applying science for practical application of the pure sciences, maneuvering in a desired direction, or calculated manipulation. You can see where we're going with this. You put the two definitions together for social engineering itself, you can come up with something that says it's the art or science of manipulating an individual to take a desired action, whether that action be good or not. This is actually, social engineering itself is actually used in everyday life. It's not always something bad, it's not always something malicious. We actually start out learning very young as children what social engineering is. As a child, you know, we're a lot of times we're self-centered. The world revolves around us. What do? We pout, we bitch fits, throw tantrums. We do anything to get somebody at a higher level, an adult, to pay attention to us, to try to change our surroundings to benefit us or reflect everything around us. So it starts off as something very young. Parents as well use social engineering. We try to elicit feelings of guilt or shame in our child. Some of us know that better than others. We also want to try to instill in them a sense that they need to seek our approval before they go out and do something. Still another form of social engineering. Even doctors, psychologists, and therapists use elements of social engineering to manipulate I know that sounds like a bad word, but we're going to use it anyway, manipulate their patients into performing actions for their benefit. So, you know, you can see that, like I said, social engineering is not something that's always bad. There's a direct contradiction to it. You know, we're not always, you know, seeking to bring devastation to whatever we're trying to do. Types of social engineering attacks can be broken down into two basic types. We have computer-based and we have human-based, or more the face-to-face. Computer-based phishing and spear phishing, email attachments, fake websites, and pop-ups. We all know what phishing attacks are, right? I mean, who here is not related to the Prince of Nigeria? I mean, we've all received those emails. One thing to note, the difference between phishing and spear phishing, phishing itself is a raw generalization to see how many people you can get. Spear phishing itself is a more targeted expedition. You're going after something very particular. You detail that something, whatever you're trying to get them to go for, you detail that and tailored it specifically for them. So that's the difference between the two. We all know what email attachments are, and we've all dealt with pop-up windows. Human-based, shoulder surfing. It's very simple. It's just as simple as me standing behind Luke when he's sitting there typing his password into the username field, and it's wide open there to see. You sit next to somebody, train, subway, library, anywhere, overhear things, see things, read things. You get a lot of the information that way. Impersonation and third-party attacks. Impersonation is pretty clear. You know, it's where you pretend to be an employee or a valid user or whatever you're going after to try to gain access to it. Third-party attacks is where you're actually pretending to you're acting on the authority of somebody else. Okay, so an example: Mr. Smith is out of town on vacation, but he's an executive at this company. You come in, you're talking to the receptionist. Well, Mr. Smith, I had this appointment with him. Did I get my dates wrong? Why is he here? Well, he said that I could leave this for him or leave this on his desk, or he said that I could go in and say, fix this. Okay. That's one way to gain access. Insider attacks. Insider attacks, can't find a way in? Join. You're hired. You're now an employee. You got full access. If you can't make it that far, trust me, there's always some disgruntled employee somewhere. You can't make everybody happy. And you usually can get somebody who's disgruntled to start talking pretty easily. You start relating to their problems, they're gonna open up. Like every other process or thing we try to do, we have a framework that we have to follow. We have a set of rules, set of guidelines. Social engineering is no different. There is a social engineering framework. You can set out, start gathering all this information, but if this information, what good is it if you have no way to know how to apply it? You use this example of, you know, building a house. When you're building a house, do you start with a roof? I mean, if you start with a roof, you're not going to get very far. They start with a solid foundation. So an overview of this framework starts out with information gathering. Obviously, I mean, more information you go, the more powerful you're going to be, the more knowledgeable, the more flexible you'll be able to be. Elicitation, bringing something out in somebody. And you got your pretext. And this all leads into target manipulation. So for information gathering, well, what are we going to gather information on? We need to profile the target. Who or what are we targeting? You need to be able to understand the organization. What does the organization do? Do they provide a service to other companies, other organizations? Do they manufacture a product? What is that product used for? There's all kinds of aspects you can go into to understanding the organization. Know who the key individuals are. This is fairly important. You need to find the names of the individuals who are going to be some of the busiest individuals within the company. HR representatives and employees are fairly high targets, because that is their job, really, when you think about it. Their job is to read all these emails, to take in all these applications, to do all this research, to interact with those coming into the company. So HR itself is one of the highest vulnerable attack vectors within a company. When you're going to research a company, you need to find out who the management, who the important managers are, what they do, as much about them as you possibly can. Human resources, like I said, you want to find some of the most busiest people there, because when you throw out these names are going to be names that are known company-wide, and they're going to know that, hey, I'm probably not going to be able to contact them instantly to be able to get verification of what this guy's saying. IT and technical employees. This is something you normally avoid, but with social engineering, you don't. If you're going in on a computer-based attack, you want to, so like a fishing expedition or whatever, you're usually ignoring these guys, because these are the guys that are supposed to be stopping all this stuff from happening. These are the guys that are going to say, I see what's going on here, and they're going to put a stop to it. But when you're going more towards the face-to-face end of things, you need to know these guys' names and what they do. Because this will get you in the door, and this will get you into places that you really probably shouldn't be. But this is your job. This is what you're trying to do. So you may ask, how do I find information on these people? Well, some of the common sources, Google, search engines. You got LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, social media. It's really big, and it's getting even bigger. It's a very cheap and inexpensive way for a company to go out, put their product out, put their face out into the commercial market, and people to be able to get in contact with them. You're seeing Twitter accounts for these companies pop up every single day. Makes customer service a lot easier, too. Personal websites, blogs, and videos. Those are my personal favorite, actually. I get to personal website, I get to see a lot about you. I get to see some of your dialect. I get to see how you talk. I get to see a little bit of how you think, but how you organized your site. Blogs, well, you're pretty much filling out your personal life or grievance or whatever to, whoever wants to read it. That gives me a fairly good way to get in to start a conversation with you. Videos, excellent sources of information. I get to see your body language. I get to see your movements. I get to see or hear your voice and how you talk and what you say and the things that you do. It's great sources of information. Your traditional sources is your corporate websites and publicly accessible servers. A lot of companies have a website themselves. There's all kinds of information out there on the company itself that they put out there they want you to use or want you to have. That turns out to be a fairly great starting point for me wanting to know, hey, what's this company do? Public data and reports from third-party sources. Public data, financial reports, earnings, losses, stock reports. There's a lot of third-party companies that profile this kind of information for these companies. Great places to start looking for information. Non-traditional sources, outside interactions with employees. The most recent experience that came to mind with me was here recently, one of the companies here in town came and gave a speech to some IEEE members about joining their company or what that company had to offer. Well, not only did I get some of the names of some of the busiest people in there, their job is to go out and recruit, and some of the HR names, I also found out, that one of the things that they prided themselves on was outside interaction with employees. They have sports, bowling, baseball, softball, golf. They have all kinds of them. They promote the fact that they want their employees to have interaction with each other outside of the workplace. What does that mean for a social engineer? I just start showing up some of these places. If I can find out a location where some of these things are happening, just start showing up. I don't have to say anything. I don't have to do anything. I just got to sit there and watch and listen. I may hear some other names come up. Those are other things I can go look up. I might hear, so-and-so's got this problem with their manager, or there's deadlines due or something, and somebody's pressing them, they're not too happy about it. That gives me something else to go after. Eventually, if I start showing up long enough, often enough, I might even actually be pulled into there because I'm now a familiar face. Third-party experts, that covers individuals or people that are actually, as it says, experts in the field, okay? They're an expert on the product that this company puts out. Maybe this company is not the only company that does this. Those are all really good sources of information. Elicitation. I'll start out again with some definitions. Elicit. To draw out, to provoke, to arrive at a conclusion by logic. I'm sure that doesn't really give you the kind of goosebumps it does me. I mean, it kind of gets me really, you know, warm fuzzy, but it should evoke some sort of emotional response from you when you actually think about that definition. I guarantee you, if it doesn't, there's probably a problem. Why does elicitation work so well? Well, here's a couple examples here. Most people have the desire to be polite, especially to strangers. For example, customer service. Company's goal is to make the customer happy, no matter what. This is within reasonable means. Many individuals respond well to someone who is showing genuine concern for their well-being. Something happened to you, she lost a cat, show some concern, you're going to open up. Maintain their ego. Well, that's not hard to do. It really isn't hard to do. You play to the fact that most people want to appear informed and intelligent. You give praise to someone, and it's a very easy way to get them to start talking. It takes no effort at all to get somebody to start talking about their accomplishments, especially once you start complimenting on some of the things and you show interest and want to draw them out. It's a very easy way to get them to start talking. Another thing about elicitation, the NSA defined it out in some of the training materials that they set out as a subtle extraction of information during an apparently normal and innocent conversation. So maybe that brings that home to you a little more. Many governments, they do train for this. This is one area that is trained for government employees because it is so common and spies all over the world use this. I know from personal experience, my brother, who's recently joined the National Guard, he finished his basic training and was coming home for the holidays. Before he came home, they had an entire briefing on this of tactics, things that people do to try to get information from you. One of the ones he told me about specifically was, you have a team of people working. Somebody comes along as you're backing out of a parking space. Somebody comes along and hits you. Oh, I'm sorry, I just rear-ended you. That starts the conversation right there. Somebody else comes along. Next thing you know, you might be giving out some information you really shouldn't be doing. So this does happen. This is trained for. And it's something that I think that a lot of companies need to address a little better than what they do. So what are some of the goals for elicitation? Well, going back to the definition, I mean, that's kind of easy to see. I mean, you want to provoke a response from an individual to some desired action. As a social engineer, you want to lead the target to take an action, whether it be giving you information or access to a building. Mastering the art of communication is key to successful elicitation. 3 points for mastering the art of communication. Educate yourself on what you're talking about. Know what you're talking about. There's nothing that'll kill your engagement faster than not appearing to know what you're talking about. Be natural. It's kind of hard to be, natural in some situations, like, now I'm late. I was nervous about doing this anyway, and look at me now. Don't be greedy. Know your limits. Okay. Just because you got in the door the first time don't mean you're going to get everything you need. You may be coming back. All this leads into what we call is preloading. Preloading is, like it says, they're basically the influence and the target on how to react to certain information. We see this every day. How many of you have been to the movies recently? So you're walking up to the theater, Okay, you're going up there to buy your, $7, $8 ticket. What's all around you? Posters for upcoming events. This movie, coming soon, has some of the most interesting pictures within the movie on that poster. You haven't seen it, then there's no need to go see it, is it? So you got your ticket. You're going and you're standing in line at concessions, and so you spent $8 on your ticket, and you're fixing to spend $60 on Coke and popcorn and everything else. You finally make it to your seat in the theater, okay? You sit down, and what starts? More preloading. You get this coming soon. Most epic adventure of your lifetime. Summer 2013. what are they doing? They're preloading you to say, hey, I want to watch that movie. So this is something that's another important aspect that's important to social engineering, being able to lead somebody in the direction you want to go. This all leads into the pretext. We've got our information. We've got some idea of how to get what we want out of the target. We know who we're targeting. We got to be believable in doing it. You can't just walk up and say, hey, give me this. This isn't first grade anymore. We're not on the playground. Like I've been doing, we'll start out with the definition. Pretext is the act of creating a scenario or situation in which a target is comfortable with, releasing information, or performing an action. The success of your pretext relies on how well your information gathering skills are. Information gathering is extremely important. It's more than just creating a lie. You're creating a whole new identity. You become somebody else. You live another life history. As it stands for itself, you don't exist anymore. You are that person. Everything from the fact that where you went to school, who you dated, possibly, depending on how small the company is, local landmarks, where you say you're from, who you're married, you've got kids, are you supposed to have kids? You know, those things are very important. Those details, if not looked at and put into your pretext, left out, shows inconsistency, you're done for. The only thing you can do is tuck your tail between your legs and turn around and walk away. So what are some of the basic principles of pretexting? There's quite a few, but I made a short list here. Some of them seem like some of the most important ones. The simpler the pretext is better, obviously. Sometimes there's a lot to remember. You may need more than one pretext. You're going to one business in the morning. You're going to another location sometime after lunch. And right before everybody gets off, you're hitting a third location. You're going to be the same person. Do you need to be the same person at all three places? Or do you need multiple identities? So the simpler, the better. Because there can be a lot to remember. The more research that is done, the greater your chance of success is. And that kind of goes without saying. We all know the more information we got, the better off we're going to be. Know the type of person that you will be coming in contact with. Try to already have an idea of how they think, what they are, how they talk. And mimic the expressions and dialect of the target. Smoke breaks last, 5 minutes? That? Somebody right, would put out on Twitter, hey, I'm going on smoke break. It's a perfect opportunity for me to walk up to you and start a conversation. One of the first things I'm going to start doing, I'm going to start looking at how you're talking, how you're acting. I'm going to look at some of the expressions that you use when certain things are brought up. I'm going to mimic you as much as possible because if you're having a bad day, I'm going to have a bad day. If you're having a good day, I'm having a good day. This all goes along with playing along with them because this will build a sense of trust. This will build a sense of confidence in them that they will be able to tell you stuff. And depending on what you're going after, like I said, this group of employees, you hit the right button, it's all going to spill out there anyway. You really ain't going to work for it. But be prepared when you're doing this because you will be confronted. At some point in time, there will be somebody come up and says, who are you? What are you doing here? You will be challenged. You have to be able to answer these questions. If you're not able to answer these questions and there's some inconsistency or loophole in your pretext and or you don't show any confidence in who you say you are, they're going to know, hey, you're not supposed to be here. Next thing you know, you got six security officers coming to haul you back down the elevator. That never ends good. Know when to walk away. Know when you've outstayed your welcome. We all kind of have a pretty good sense of that already, right? I mean, in social situations or even at home, arguments or whatever, going to a friend's house, something didn't go well. Know when to walk away. So now that we have our pretext and we have our information, we have some of the funny stuff. Target manipulation. To be able to understand how to manipulate a target, you've got to understand how they think. And there are certain modes of thinking. There's a lot of research into this. There's a lot of other places you can go look up things for this. I figured I'd throw out to you, the FBI put out a law enforcement bulletin that had several interesting statements on the modes in which people think. Quoting them here, it says, simply confirming your nonverbal behavior to the client, using language from the client's preferred representational system, and matching speech, volume, tone, and area of speech often overcomes client reluctance to communicate. So what does that exactly say? If you can figure out the target's dominant mode of thinking, and you're able to confirm this in somewhat of a subtle manner so that you know you're right, you can bring them around to open it up to you, tell you almost anything. Whether they did it or not, that may not come out of them, but hey, you may end up hearing about their girlfriend problems at home. It's a very, very useful and powerful tool to be able to understand how somebody thinks. The modes of thinking can actually be broken down into these categories with the senses, dominant sense, and the importance of understanding the mode. The senses, we all know our five senses, right? We got our sight, hearing, touch, smell, and taste. We've learned those all our life. Did you know there's actually five others that have been added to that list? Those are balance, pain, acceleration, and joint motion, sense of time, and temperature differences. I know you may not believe me on some of these, but here's an example. You're having to change a light bulb. You've got to get up on a ladder to change a light bulb. What happens when you touch a light bulb? Well, you feel heat. There's your sense of temperature changes. Dog runs by, knocks your ladder over. You're going down. What happens? Well, you realize what direction you're going. You have a sense of time. Time seems to just slow down. It takes you forever to hit the floor, doesn't it? So there are these others, but they all break down into your dominant sense. Out of our five main senses, only three of them tend to dominate and are associated with your mode of thinking. You have your sight or your visual thinker. You have your hearing or your auditory thinker. You have your feeling or kinesthetic thinker. And all of those are your three main categories. There can be others that are mixed in with there. You can have variations, but these are the three most dominant. For the sight, the majority of people are visual. That's mostly what you'll find when you're out talking to people. Some of the phrases you'll hear them say the most is, "I see what you mean," or "That looks good to me." That's one of the cues to say, hey, he might be a visual thinker. Visual thinkers tend to remember colors and textures, whether it's light or dark. Your hearing or auditory thinkers, they remember sounds. Was it too loud, too high, too low? Did she whisper too low? Music's too loud. You also hear them say things like, something tells me. That sounds okay to me. That sounds like a general phrase, but you get somebody who's using it quite a bit, that might be a fairly good key to say, hey, he's auditory. And that's how, when I'm talking to him, that's how I'm going to portray myself and how I'm going to get my information across to him. I'm not going to try approaching him in any of these other senses. I'm going to go directly to what he uses to think with. The kinesthetic thinker, they're usually concerned with feelings or how an event made them feel. For example, you know, the warm sun and the beautiful breeze. You usually see them fairly artistic. They remember like the fear they felt while riding a roller coaster. They remember, you know, how they felt watching that horror movie. You'll often hear them say something like, I can grasp that idea. I'll get in touch with you. Or I just wanted to touch base. These modes of thinking are often also more dominant towards the different sexes. A lot of women you'll see are more of the feeling or kinesthetic thinkers. You can see that just by, you know, go to a department store, JCPenney, something like that, and watch. See how many walk by and have to touch everything that they go by. Or as they're looking at something, they've got to feel it. They rub their hand across it. It's a pretty good chance that they're a kinesthetic thinker. IQs. Easiest to see, hardest to identify. The reason I say that the hardest to identify is because between races, cultures, even sexes, it's hard to identify a baseline. It's really hard to get a baseline on IQs, which makes it really hard to determine, hey, is that really a change or is it just something I would want? Another thing to remember with IQs is while you're watching them, to see whether or not they're believing you, or how, if you're getting across to them. They're watching you too. They're watching to see what you do, how you act. They're doing a lot of the same things you're doing. They may not be doing it for the same reasons. They may not be putting it in the same perspective you are, but they are. And that is something that will stick to them. That is something that will come back to haunt you if it didn't go well. Because you may actually be coming across them again. Facial expressions. Facial expressions are actually universal. That's one thing I never really thought about. Universal face expressions. Some of the ones, there's several, but some of the ones that are universal are happiness, fear, anger, sadness, and they go across cultures. It doesn't matter. Certain movements in the face, involuntary muscle movements in the face, cause certain reactions in every single one of these. Trick is identifying them. There's people that spend their entire life trying to identify these and still aren't really great at it. Thing about these, they last 1/25th of a second. That's how long you've got to take. You've got to pick up on the cue of a facial expression. We all know that show that started, I think it was what, 2007, 2008, something like that, that's Lie to Me. It's based off of this. Of course, it's got the Hollywood flair kind of thing to it, but a lot of the underlying principles are sound. Another thing about facial expressions, they're always linked to an emotion. Thing is, even though they are linked to an emotion, the expression doesn't always tell you why they're having that emotion is being displayed. It doesn't always tell you why they're having that emotional response. So that's something you got to keep in the back of your mind. You're talking to a female. Somebody else walks in and she looks at him and she shows signs of disgust. Is she disgusted at him? Or did he evoke some memory of somebody in her past that brought up that? You've got to be careful about reading your facial expression. The thing about facial expressions, because they are universal and linked to emotions, you can use them to create an emotional response. Now, I know every one of you is going to go home tonight, you're going to look up facial expressions, you're going to watch YouTube videos or whatever, you're going to sit there in the mirror and you're going to practice these, right? Right? Go on. The interesting thing here is, you start mimicking these facial expressions, pay attention to your emotions when you're doing it. You will start feeling the emotion that your facial expression is mimicking. If you don't write off, don't worry about it, just keep practicing. But it will happen. Facial expressions, they can be used to identify contradictions and change in behavior. Is somebody, the facial expression changed when you brought up a certain subject? Did they start looking away from you? That goes back into IQs. They turn away, did they turn ahead completely, or did they just look away? Did they look down? These are things that you look for, changes in behavior. These things signify things either you want to stay away from or other areas that you might end up pursuing to try to get more information. Human buffer overflow. I'm going to steal a phrase from my DE teacher. This is full of awesomeness and coolness. I really think it is. It works a lot in the same ways as a buffer overflow in the program does. We say that the mind runs software. We'll say that this software, as time goes by, you build up a set of instructions to which to operate by. You have a set of buffers, and you actually set memory length for certain memories. Okay, is this enjoyable? How long of this time period am I going to remember? You don't realize you're doing this, but this is all going on in the background. Like I said, it's similar to a buffer overflow in a program, and it injects commands. You can inject commands to manipulate the process of thought in a certain direction, the direction that you want to take this individual. And while your brain doesn't crash like the software program does, it does have a momentary lapse that will allow for the injection of a command. So on the next slide, this is where I was trying to keep things interactive. I got a little bit of an exercise here. I want you, when I pull up this slide, to try and read the color of the word, not the word itself. Did you catch yourself going back, trying to correct yourself several times? Or if you didn't really have a problem with it at all, do it faster. Keep going faster, 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 faster. You'll find this is difficult because of the injected commands. This is a human buffer overflow. Our brains want to read the words and not the colors. It's just really how we're wired. Our brain sees the color, but it reacts to the word first. So the first thought in our mind is the word, not the color. I found that extremely interesting. So that covers why it was difficult and what it shows. And you see that most decisions are made with more than just what you hear. And I'll be covering that in just a second. How many of you have been driving along and you don't remember getting from point A to point B? I've done it. 5:30 in the morning, it's dark, I'm on my way to work. I get to work and I'm like, I don't remember taking that turn. Hope I didn't run off the road. Obviously I didn't because I'm still here, but I ain't got a clue how I got there. It happens. This goes to show that our decisions are made with more than just what we hear. Some scientists actually say that decisions are made up to 7 seconds earlier in the subconscious before they become evident in reality. So this here is what shows that when people do finally make a decision, it's not just based on what they hear, but it's also based on their sight and emotions and how they're feeling at that time. So going on in target manipulation, building an instant rapport. We'll start with defining it like always. It's a relation marked by conformity or harmony. It's a fairly simple definition. It starts with listening. Remember, when you're in an engagement, you're there for them to talk. You want to hear them talk. You're not there for them to listen to you talk, you to hear yourself talk. Let them do the talking. Don't interrupt somebody with a me story. No matter how great yours is, wait for them to finish. And if the opportunity presents itself, then bring up yours. And that's only done just to show, hey, I was listening and I can relate. When you finally come face to face with somebody, building a rapport is instant. It happens like that. You are really trying to develop a relationship with a target. I don't mean relationship like, hey, you're going to go out with me kind of thing. Okay? I mean relationship is, hey, you meant something to me. Okay? We're going to be best friends, you know, from here on out. Send you a Facebook request. You do this by developing a common ground. And going back to like I said again before, mirroring your speech and behavior to what they're displaying. There's nothing that'll develop a relationship faster than common ground. One thing to be mindful of is that relationship, that rapport can be destroyed faster than it was ever created. And that goes back to also knowing when to walk away. And closing on a target. You know, there were several people I saw, they say that this is actually more important than starting it, closing it. You want to leave them with a logical follow-through. So, for example, you go to see your doctor. Your doctor says, you got a problem. Your doctor comes in there, looks at your chart, and says, okay, see you in 6 months, and walks out the door. You're sitting there thinking, okay, what am I supposed to do? Believe it or not, people actually want to be told what to do. So this is why you leave them with a logical follow-through. Your doctor would say, you know, do this, this, and this. It's all in your best interest. And then walk out the door. That leaves you with a sense of feeling good. Okay, yeah, I can overcome this. Yeah, I can do this. This is what I need to do. What do you do? Depending on how serious it is, you should go out and do it. But you might not. I don't know how many times doctors told me I need to lose weight. Look at me. You know? Don't leave a bad taste in their mouth. Don't be a complete tool with your interactions with them. Me, personally, I don't know about you. Me, personally, I plan on being a consultant or working for some consulting firm doing a lot of this. It's not going to go over very well when you're sitting there in a conference room at that board table and they pull these employees in and they say, I know that guy. That's when a death stare comes in. It's a small world. And you really need to be mindful of that. I mean, I know some in here don't have Facebook. I mean, I've had a Facebook account for a while. I don't have that many friends on it, but if you don't believe how small of a world it actually is, just go look on Facebook. Start making connections between people, likes, interests, friends lists. You'll find eventually you're going to come back around in one big circle. And you're going to find some people that you know who know somebody else, that know somebody else, and know somebody else that you know. So it is a small world. And you need to maintain some sort of professionalism while you're doing this. So now we've manipulated the target into doing what we want to do. We need to know also how to influence them. Manipulation, it does a lot, but influence, it falls under that too, but it's still enough to be its own separate category. You got reciprocation, It's an inherent expectation that when others treat you well, you respond to them in the same manner. For example, you're walking into a building, somebody's behind you, or they're ahead of you, and you know the door's held open for one of you. What's expected of you as you walk through that door? You're expected to be courteous. You're supposed to say thank you as you walk past them. And at the next door, hold it open for them. They're expecting you to hold the next door because they held it for you. That's reciprocity. Obligation and concession also fall under that, but they kind of take a little bit their own direction. For obligation, you compliment somebody and follow up with a question. It's kind of hard for me not to answer a question after I've just been given a compliment, right? Keep the compliments professional. You say the wrong thing to somebody, you're going to have the 6 security guards around you being dragged down the elevator again. Like I said, that never ends well. Another way of influencing target is create scarcity. How many's got iPhones? I mean, or we know people who have iPhones. Why do they got to get the next iPhone? It's not going to be available. Scarcity of a product. It's used all the time in marketing. I've got to have this because there may not be enough of them. I don't need it. I want it. Then you lead in social proof. We've all heard of peer pressure kind of thing. This same kind of thing. This is what happens when someone is unable to determine the mode of thinking or appropriate behavior in a situation. What do? When we find ourselves in that situation, we're a complete stranger. We just walked into a group of total strangers. What do? First thing we do, we start looking around the room. We start seeing what other people are doing, how they're acting. And that is what we consider appropriate from that point on. To be able to influence the target using social proof, you usually show them that this behavior is accepted because they're doing it. That carries a lot of weight. More than it should, carries a lot of weight. So some of the tools of the trade. We've got our information, we've got our pretext, we've gotten in the door, we've got a lot of what we wanted, had the target, we steered the target in the direction we want, we closed off with them and we left. So what are some of the tools that we use to do this? As I mentioned before, I mean, we got some of the social media sites, web searches, things like that. Those are all computer-based tools. Your physical tools, lock picks, cameras, recording devices, and GPS. I know this sounds a little sci-fi. You're not really out there to be, you know, James Bond or anything, but there are times where these things come in handy and when you have to use them. Even magnetic locks. I read a story where they was talking about the guy figured out how to get this magnetic lock open. He noticed that the door would actually unlock a few feet before the person came to it. So what did he do? He took a coat hanger and put a rag on the end of it. And as the door was shutting, right before it shut, got that stuck in there. Waved it around a little bit, door unlocked, open. RFID locks, there's a little more security there, but there's all kinds of tools out there that you can use to decode the lock there to have it open too. So another thing about lock picks, at least for where we live, it's illegal to have them. If you're caught with them, it's not going to end well. Unless you have a business license or license as a locksmith. I know this from not personal experience, but a guy that I had some classes with before who was a locksmith filled me in on this. GPS, well, that's obvious. One note about GPS. A lot of the pictures that we take on, you see a lot of pictures. I mean, taking my cell phones nowadays, especially social media. These contain metadata. This metadata also contains GPS coordinates of where this picture was taken. It's a good way to track somebody down.
You don't really call it geotagging.
Yep. Computer-based tools, Multigo, Social Engineer Toolkit, and Common User Passwords Profile. These are all software. Multigo is open source. It is an open source intelligent application. It allows you to, it gives an interface for data mining and gathering and allows for you to put the clues together, put one and one together, get to. You'll find a lot of links between individuals, likes, dislikes, interests, things you harvest from the other places I mentioned for information gathering. It's a good place to put it. It's a great tool. I think your screenshot should have, but it's something that's worth looking at if this is what you're looking to do. A Social Engineer Toolkit. It is a collection of Python scripts, some of the most commonly used attack vectors for social engineering. A lot of those tools are included in Backtrack already. You'll find those there. I'm not sure about the Common User Passwords Profile. It's another program that just goes along and tries out different combinations of common passwords. And I meant to actually get a breakdown of some of the most commonly used passwords. It's interesting to look at look at that. I think the last ones that I was able to find was from like 2009. So I did put them in here.
They've actually changed due to my amusement. I believe one of the most common currently is password followed by a 1.
Yeah.
And it changed over the years basically because of the increased attempts at password security, which were mostly misguided.
Yep. And I mean, I brought up the year of the hack, which was 2011. That's actually a term that was given by the media itself. There was a lot of things. That's when Anonymous really started coming out. That's what really drew a lot of media attention to this and how things kind of got to where they are now. And another interesting thing about passwords, it actually is distinct between the sexes of what uses which. They are just as simple between the two, but they are different. So some of the prevention and mitigation. Learn to identify social engineering attacks, a lot of which I kind of discussed here. Outline the importance of the type of information sought by social engineers. This is one thing that's not done in corporate policy now. Most of the time when you go to these meetings, it's don't click on this, right? Don't open this. Don't download this. Don't go to this site. I think more awareness needs to be brought out to this type of information. Of course, enforcement of existing policies. What good are they if you don't enforce them? Clean desk policies. You're not allowed to leave this type of information on the desk, out in the open, passwords, things like that. Those need to be implemented and enforced. And as always, I think we said this in like every single presentation, keep your software updated. Social engineering, while it does have a very high human aspect to it, it also has that digital aspect to it. Keep your stuff updated. And of course, security through education.
Now, one thing you didn't point out there specifically, that I would say that it takes a social engineer to prevent social engineering attacks.
Yeah, it does.
Because it's not specifically a malicious title necessarily.
Not always,
it's not by your definitions. In order to identify and in order to create policies that'll work, you pretty much have to be able to understand how people think.
Right? One other thing I didn't bring up, a lot of corporations, companies that even have some of these policies already implemented to defend against social engineers, you'll still find one key point lacking. That is, I see this guy digging in the trash. What do I do? Who do I call? Okay. That's also something that really does need to be addressed. Because a lot of times people do see these guys going around looking for this information. And they just think, maybe he should be here, maybe he shouldn't. Well, if he's not supposed to be here and I know it, who do I call? I mean, a lot of times that's not in there. So that's something else that I think needs to be addressed in a lot of the summary conclusions. I hope from this presentation you've come away to see that social engineering is not always negative. I hope I've driven home that information is key. The more information you've got, the more flexible you are, the more you're able to do. Your pretext makes you believable. You are who you say you are. You have to be. Going back into that, you can't let your own personal feelings or emotions affect you in any way while you're doing this. Brought up the main topics of influence and manipulation, and made aware of malicious tactics. Any questions or comments?
Well, I don't know how well you drove it home, but this is one of the other aspects that's really important about this is, even if you're developing software, I mentioned that password policies, the password strength policies are often kind of misguided, and that boils down to being in the same category of problem. You've got to understand how your users think before you have a password policy that you're attempting to enforce. If I say that you have to put in 8 characters and one of them has to be either a number or a special character, then you better believe that a lot of people are going to put password followed by the number 1, because the policy will allow that. There's more effort spent by most users trying to subvert it to make a password that they can remember easily than by users who actually try to conform to it. So you can actually reduce the security of your password, security in general, by creating a password security policy that has something that the users think is an arbitrary requirement. And there's a lot of other things that happen like that in security as well. Another aspect that I'll hit real quick, unless you were going to say something to passwords, is what I've heard described as the tyranny of the default. Most users will select they will not change any security options. They will pick whatever it comes with. So if you're putting out software that has the ability to use an encrypted communications, know, if you've got a, if you're putting out some new fancy web program, web application, you really want it to be secured, but you say, well, I don't want the average user to have to be forced into using this security, this encryption, then if you have the default option to be having that encryption turned off, 90% of the installations of that web application are going to be insecure. Nobody is going to bother turning on the encryption because they simply will not know it's there.
So, is there anything else? I believe I'm done then. I appreciate you guys sticking around and listening to me. I hope you've had something that you can take away from this, actually learn or apply in some other aspect of your life, because this isn't just something that is used to try to gain access to a corporation or something. I mean, this is stuff that can be applied through everyday relationships, everyday communication. Just real quickly going over some more references. This is the book I use, Social Engineering, The Art of Human Hacking. He also has a website that goes along with it. It details a lot of the same stuff as the book does, and has a few videos and stuff on there. Adrian Crenshaw at irongeek.com. It's an amazing resource for anything head test related. And of course, the company that produces MultiGo is available at